second case of the morning, Sidoris Deputy versus Lehman Brothers. Mr. Berbian.
Thank you.
Mr. Berbian.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Nicholas Berbarian on behalf of Lehman Brothers, Inc. This matter comes before this court pursuant to an appeal under Section 16 of the Federal Arbitration Act with respect to the district court's decision not to enforce the arbitration provisions contained in a standard customer agreement signed by the plaintiff while her account was maintained at Lehman Brothers for a period of 15 months. The court's decision was premised on two bases. One, the court believed that Lehman Brothers had not sufficiently established that the plaintiff had signed those agreements. Second, the court found that even if the plaintiff had signed those agreements, that they could not be enforced as a matter of public policy, notwithstanding the express Supreme Court decisions and decisions of this circuit court to the contrary. The controversy arises out of the plaintiff opening an account at Lehman Brothers in October of 2000. That came about because Lehman Brothers purchased certain retail accounts that had previously been serviced and the property of S.G. Cowan and Company. One of those accounts was the account that belonged to the plaintiff. What Lehman Brothers did not know was that prior to that time, Frank Rutadoria, the broker at issue, had been misappropriating certain funds and sending phony statements to those clients in order to cover up for those misappropriations. What is also undisputed is that after Lehman Brothers acquired this account, not one penny was misappropriated while the account was at Lehman Brothers. Rather, the plaintiff's theory in this case is that the plaintiff is entitled to what was on the phony statements that she continued to receive from Mr. Grudadoria. As far as Lehman's standard practices, customer agreements were sent and we believe signed by the plaintiff in this matter. The district court did three things with respect to those customer agreements. One, it rejected the testimony of Lehman's expert witness on handwriting, on Daubert theories and otherwise, which I will come back to in a moment. Second, though, having made that decision and told us to proceed accordingly, we then came forward with clear exemplars of Ms. Deputy's handwriting, exemplars which we have set forth in our brief, seven of them, comparing them to the question signatures on the two customer agreements. Under Rule 901, that is a perfectly acceptable and permissible way to establish authenticity of handwriting, yet the district court refused to consider that evidence.
Well, that's an interesting argument. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
You're saying the district judge has an obligation, mandatory obligation in a case like this, to make that comparison and form his opinion and announce that opinion, and that's required.
For this reason, Section 4 of the Federal Arbitration Act mandates that there be a trial with respect to the making of an arbitration agreement if the person contesting the arbitration agreement comes forward with sufficient evidence. This court, in its Tinder decision, held it akin to summary judgment.
Are you saying that this is a rule only if arbitration is an issue, or in any case where handwriting is at issue?
You're absolutely correct that with respect to any case, if the Daubert theory typically comes up in a jury trial and typically there would be a proceeding and a motion in limine in advance. If for some reason an expert is excluded, there should be nothing that would preclude a party from presenting to the trier of fact, whether it be a jury or to a judge, and this was a bench trial, obviously, similar handwriting for the judge to do the comparison. The judge did not do the comparison.
I'm not questioning your right to ask the judge to do it, but you're saying the judge must make that finding. That's your argument.
Yes. Right? When a judge on an issue central to the case is presented clearly relevant and highly probative evidence and does not even consider it, we respectfully submit that that in and of itself is reversible error. And
on saying that there's been no determination of whether or not it was her authentic signature?
There is no question.
And so there's going to be no arbitration? Is that your concern?
That is what the judge's concern was on the first prong of his holding, that we hadn't established because he threw out our expert, and only because he threw out our expert, that we hadn't established the signature. So once the expert was thrown out, we don't believe that was correct, but then we said, okay, judge, if you're going to throw out the expert, here's the signatures that we have. You do the comparison and give us the limited right to take limited discovery to get more and cross-examine Miss Deputy about this signature. Well, one must keep in mind here.
Following your argument, which I think is sort of strange, what if the judge looks at it and says, no, they're not the same? Are you stuck with that?
We're stuck with that. Then we'd be under a clearly erroneous standard. We'd be stuck with it. But what we're entitled to, what any litigant is entitled to, is to have the trier of fact consider highly probative and relevant evidence, and that didn't occur here. Together with...
Shot over here.
I'm sorry.
Just want a question about if the judge looks at it and decides they're not the same, do we have to look at it the same way then?
Unfortunately, we would be stuck with you having to give him the utmost deference with respect to that determination. But that didn't even occur here.
We wouldn't have to review the bidding because we had the same documents that he had. Generally speaking, when you're making a ruling based on something that's available to us just as much as it is to him, we do it de novo.
And you're certainly entitled to do that under these circumstances and looking at these signatures.
So we would have to do it de novo then.
Or reverse and send it back for a full and fair hearing on this issue.
No. You said you got stuck with it once he said they did look the same. And I wonder what happens when it gets here. Do we do the same thing?
Well, you're entitled since it was evidence that was not considered.
What? No.
But had he considered
had
it?
He considered it.
Had he
and
considered
had he
it,
found, as Judge Evans said, that the signatures weren't alike, then how would we look at it?
Clearly erroneous standard.
Why would it be clearly erroneous?
Well, only because I believe that would be a factual determination by the trier of fact.
It's facts based on something that's before him as well as us. Exactly the same. There's no difference.
Well, we would welcome a de novo review, and we would urge a de novo review, but I'm afraid that...
We're arguing about something that didn't happen. He didn't look at it anyway.
And that is where we see the real error. And Judge Evans, it goes a step further than that, because I was getting to... This is not, once you get through that gatekeeping process, just to use that word in a different context here, of finding that the person opposing arbitration has come up with enough evidence to get you a mandated Section 4 trial, her affidavit is a hearsay affidavit. We didn't even have a right to cross-examine her. So what you have is a situation here where the expert's thrown out, we come forward with these exemplars, ask for the ability to get some more exemplars and to cross-examine her, and the finding is made that we haven't established, without even considering this evidence, it's very clear from the record, the judge didn't even consider it, that we hadn't established signatures on those customer agreements when the only evidence on the other side of the equation is that affidavit signed by Ms. Deputy, not subject to cross-examination. It is hearsay. In the trial context. So there was nothing countervailing the factors which we came forward with to clear, I think, to anyone's eyes, clearly establish that Ms. Deputy, in fact, signed this agreement. And we were entitled under Section 4 to be able to pursue that route.
Was her deposition?
No, absolutely not. There was no discussion.
Did you have to take her deposition?
We did not prior to the hearing. The way it came about was we filed a motion to compel arbitration after we were comfortable that these were her signatures. There was opposed. We filed the affidavit of our handwriting expert in response, saying we believe they're genuine. We show up. We ask the district court's clerk, what does the judge intend to do this hearing? All we're told is, if you have any evidence, you should be prepared to present it. We appear, as you can tell from the record, Judge Cleaver makes it very clear, even before he's heard anything, that he's not inclined to grant arbitration. And I believe the public policy concerns and what factors there are hostile to arbitration, which unfortunately still exist, appear from the record to be driving that decision. But he makes it very clear that he is not going to do that and raises these issues about have we established under Daubert even that our expert can make this opinion. We believe we did. We believe we put on this woman who's done this for 21 years, testified over 115 times. Every circuit court, every single circuit court, and there's been no less than five of them, that have applied Daubert to handwriting, the 1st, 3rd, 6th, 8th, and 11th circuits, all have held that handwriting experts are admissible testimony under Daubert. And we're not talking about a jury trial here. We're talking about a bench trial.
I don't think the fairness to the district judge, he was saying that all handwriting experts are suspect and he would never receive handwriting evidence. He had a problem with this particular expert, non-disclosure of, apparently of an original analysis that was made. And it was more of a narrow ruling than kind of a broad attack on handwriting experts.
Well, Judge Evans, I'd like to address that because much has been made of this nefarious initial report. We asked her on the basis of the one handwritten document that we had, which had several lines of handwriting, therefore we thought it would have been helpful for her to look at, whether she could tell this was Miss Deputy's signature or not. She wrote us back and said, I can't tell one way or the other based upon that letter. We said, fine, we'll see what else we can find. We find the affidavit that she signs in court, clear signature, and get that to her, and she says, now I can tell. There was no discovery directed at us that would have required us to disclose that initial report. We brought her whole file with her to the hearing. Counsel asked for it, and we gave it to her. This nefarious report, I think, only helps us. It shows the care on which she proceeded. She looked at it initially, and on that one document, she says, I can't determine one way or the other. All of a sudden, that gets turned into the trial of us trying to withhold evidence, hide documents. None of that occurred. There was never a discovery request. There was never any hearing that would have required us to produce those materials initially. And the same with respect to the holding of Malinchinsky. There was this reference in his brief, even, that her opinion was excluded. And a clear reading of Malinchinsky shows that it was not excluded. There was a report filed with respect to her expert opinion. There's a tax court rule that says you can't testify beyond the scope of the report. So her testimony was limited to the scope of her report, but she was accepted as an expert. She has never been...
focus on that Malinchinsky thing. I did notice in the district court statement, he said, he asked her about it, and he says, and if you are the same person, it says that the court rejected your expert report. What's her name?
Diane Marsh.
Marsh's answer is, I'm not familiar with that.
She testified in 1997, that's correct.
Oh, so she didn't remember that. So
and that's not the result in the case.
Well, then he says at the end, as noted at the inception of this witness's testimony, she has failed to accurately recount her credentials, and in particular, the fact that her testimony has been previously rejected in court. And that refers to the Malinchinsky.
And the reading, any fair reading of Malinchinsky, her testimony was not rejected.
Well, I did look at it. It does appear that she did testify and that she was qualified as a witness, but her testimony was limited to her report under some rule that says you can't talk beyond the report.
And the reason for that was it was unfair for cross-examination, in that case, for the IRS, for her to go beyond what had been disclosed before. But there was no rejection in that report, and in that opinion from this circuit, in any way, shape, or form, rejecting her as an expert.
So the judge was wrong on that?
Absolutely wrong. Thank you.
Before you sit down, why wasn't her deposition taken? If you knew she was going to say that I didn't sign this arbitration agreement, why wouldn't she be deposed?
Well, you know, hindsight's wonderful, and had we done this all over again, we felt very comfortable in looking at the signatures and looking at the clear match and looking at what we had, that she signed the agreement. And we thought it would have been obvious to anyone. We were wrong. And had to do it all over again, there's no question that we would have asked for that discovery before we even went to the hearing. The problem we had, and I think the problem with this case is, no one was quite sure what was going to happen on that day. And what happened, unfortunately, was the judge stood up and said, before anything happened, I'm not inclined to grant your motion, convince me to the contrary. And we went down this path. Thank you.
Mr. Shulman.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Shulman on behalf of the appellee, Doris Deputy. I want to go back to the last point Mr. Berberian made, because it's a very interesting point, and I think it shows how unfair his position is here and how unfair he was in court in front of Judge Covert. On two occasions just now, he said they were very comfortable on making this motion to compel that it is not her signature. The motion to compel was made before Ms. Deputy signed her affidavit. She signed her affidavit in September of 2002. They didn't have an opinion from their expert that, in fact, the other exemplars in Opinion 1, in fact, were her signature. In fact, the first opinion, which they did not provide along with the second opinion, which was attached to their reply brief, said, there is no match. These documents, I can't make the favorable comparisons. So that I have to make. Now, not only did they not disclose that, but they couldn't have been comfortable that Doris Deputy's signature on the supposed client agreements in 2001 were actually her signature, because they hadn't received that opinion yet from their expert. In fact, the first opinion they received on September 20 was, I can't make the comparison favorably. And only when they received, then they took Ms. Deputy's affidavit and sent it to the expert, then, after they had made their motion, did they now have some basis to go forward.
Now, this is, I think, fairly simple situation until Daubert comes in. Who did you urge the judge to make a finding based on Daubert? This was
the way this went, and again, I think this is Lehman Brothers is not fairly stating what happened. We arrive for their motion, and the court, in all honesty, sending them an important cue, a fair cue. Gentlemen, I've reviewed the briefs, I've looked at the affidavits, I've looked at the law, and I want to tell Lehman Brothers I am not inclined to grant the motion. Lehman Brothers, how do you want to proceed?
Now, he was basing that on something other than the signature then, wasn't he?
The judge had looked at the affidavit. He had looked at Ms. Marsh's report, her second report, and he was now disclosing, which trial judges do, and in fact, counsel enjoy the fact when a judge will say, here's how I'm starting at this proceeding.
You especially enjoy it when it's on your side.
Of course, you're right, Your Honor. Of course we do. But Lehman Brothers was free at that point to say, well, Judge, in light of your inclination, we would like to take some discovery. We would like to depose Ms. Deputy. We see her affidavit. We want to challenge that affidavit. We want to go behind that affidavit. There's absolutely clear from the record that Judge Clavert would have allowed that. He said, this is going to be the trial of the tail wagging the dog. It's up to you, Lehman Brothers, to tell us, how do you want to proceed? And they said, we're ready to go. We have our expert here. We'd like to proceed. And the judge said, now I want to, again, he warned them, you're going to get one attempt at this. This trial is not going to go on like a banquet that has an hors d'oeuvres and a middle course and a last course. This is it. This is your opportunity. If you don't want it today, then don't take it today. You don't have to go forward today. That was very clear that Judge Clavert made that statement. Now, what did Lehman Brothers do? They put their witness on. They didn't voluntarily disclose her first opinion. It was only after I objected to the hearing going forward without any notice that they were actually going to provide live testimony, which Judge Clavert said, no, I'm going to overrule that. Lehman Brothers has decided to proceed. They're entitled to proceed any way they want. Put your expert on. Well, during the cross-examination of the expert, I asked her, was there another report? Oh, sure. Now, she didn't give it to counsel. Counsel didn't bring that report. It was in her book bag underneath the table.
I guess, to get back to my question, I think it's an entirely different case if the judge says, I think this expert's not credible, and I'm not going to receive the opinion for that reason. But the judge gets wrapped up in Daubert here. And I want to know who planted that seed decided on his own.
I think the judge felt that his role as the gatekeeper, as he used that phrase in his both oral statements and in his written opinion, was to see whether this opinion was credible, was it reliable. And I think he thought the Daubert factors would apply, and I think that was an appropriate use of the Daubert factors. He was looking at reliability. What troubled him? Number one, we didn't get the first report and the second report. Number two, she had a very serious so-called typographical error in her report. She, in fact, said that the July 26, 2001 client agreement couldn't be verified as Doris Deputy's signature, and that was one of the documents later on in the report she was saying could be verified. He was troubled by the fact that she didn't articulate any principles. She said there are favorable comparisons, and when you do favorable comparisons, you look at lines, you look at starts, you look at stops, but she never had any principles to explain. For example,
didn't she go through that process?
No, she did not.
What did she just said it's her signature, that's it?
She basically said, I have made comparisons, and I find there are favorable comparisons, without any specifics as to I measured so many. There have to be so many favorable comparisons. For example, on cross, I said, well, the signatures you're looking at that you said are Doris deputy signatures do not have her middle initial involved. And she said, well, that's just a variation. I said, well, what's the difference between a variation and a favorable comparison? Well, we experts know that if you look at the letters and how they're made, that we can see the favorable comparisons. She never got down to the basis of her opinion.
You said something about what if there's a letter missing?
Yes.
That would be significant.
That would be significant.
And then when you said it was the middle initial, she said, well, not that.
Not that, exactly. In addition, she had recognized that, in fact, when you get a fax of a copy, you can't tell the starts and stops. You can't tell the thinness and thickness as you would from an original. Now, what was startling here is on her first opinion, she used two comparisons. And she said, I can't use the two comparisons. She gets another comparison. She says, well, now I have essentially one comparison, her affidavit signature, and now I can tell. Well, the affidavit signature that she received was a fax of a copy. And I think Judge
Clover... Well, what happened if she had three, though? She had the first two plus that one.
Well, she had the first two in the client agreements, but she rejected the first document she was given.
She said it's not enough. But
not
two
enough.
Two is not enough, but three might be.
Well, she ended up with just two. The Dear Frank letter, which is in the exhibits, was one she considered, and then her signature on the affidavit. And she said, well, now I've got a comparison. But she violated her own principles. She violated the principle that original documents are better. And then, and I think this is very telling, she changed her opinion from September 20th to September 24th without billing the client for any additional work. She just simply got the fax copy of the affidavit and said, there it is. Now, I think the judge was troubled by all this. What kind of detailed, scientific, reliable work was she doing? And I think the answer was she wasn't.
He was troubled, and this gets to the next that Melchinsky thing. He was troubled because even though she said she was qualified and was qualified and testified 115 times in court, he had one that he had come up with beforehand, obviously. He said, what about this Melchinsky? Well, she continued to say, I just don't remember it.
Right.
Unfortunately, I have the same problem. I don't remember the names of cases. I don't. Judge Evans was quizzing me before the argument here.
I'm glad I wasn't tested.
Well, the question here, though, is that this Malkinski thing, she was qualified to testify in that case and did testify.
Yes.
And the judge said she didn't.
No,
I can read, but he was wrong.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think what Judge Clibert was saying, first of all, he wanted to know, did she even think it was worth her time following her own work?
Are you the same person? It says the court rejected your expert report.
Right, and her expert report was rejected because the basis of the opinion were not laid out with specificity.
It didn't follow a rule of the tax court or wherever it was.
Yes, and I think the tax court rule is very much like 702.
It may be, but the point is, she's not the lawyer. And if it was an inadequate, then the lawyer goofed. He should have said, look, you've got to put all this detail in, otherwise you can't testify to it, which is what happened. She was, and that's what our court said. They agree with that. But it's not that she wasn't qualified to testify in that case, nor that she testified to the extent of whatever her report was, and that was it.
I think we have to distinguish between qualifications and whether there was adequate testimony.
I'm only looking at it the way he reacted, because he emphasized that at the inception, the witness's testimony, she failed to accurately recount her credentials, and in particular, the fact that her testimony had been previously rejected in court. And he seemed to put a lot of weight on that.
I think he was troubled in this regard. She had attached to her report, her credentials, and a list of all the cases she had testified in. It was in her hand. And he asked her, are you the same Diane Marsh who testified in the Malachinsky case? And she had no recollection. Now, she should have said, and I think it was part of, again, how sloppy this report was, how inadequate it was. She said, I don't really remember. In her hand was a list that had the Malachinsky report on it. And when I got the list from her, which she had not provided, by the way, in advance, I asked her, isn't that case listed on your resume? Because we had never received anything from Lehman Brothers. Not the first report, not a resume, just her very terse report. I do not think that that was the deciding factor for Judge Covert, but it was among the number of factors that he was looking at and said, I don't think this is reliable. I don't think this witness is credible. He did not challenge the fact that she was a qualified expert. He did not challenge or say, as Lehman Brothers suggests he said, that in fact all handwriting is rejected. Quite to the contrary. He laid out in advance that he was concerned because on his own, I have to say with a ashamed face that I did not find the Malachinsky case. This was Judge Covert who had researched on his own, had done a search, obviously, of Diane Marsh, and had found that case and was troubled by the fact. And I would also argue that I don't think it's for the lawyer alone to determine what is a sufficient basis for an expert to testify.
Well, if this is in another case, it's in a tax case, you know, but he's using it to say she was rejected, therefore she's not, didn't testify and wasn't admitted 115 times. That's all it is. It's obviously she's an expert in handwriting,
yes,
whatever that's worth, and she looks at this one. You want us to look at this de novo? He does. Obviously, we don't. But when I look at it, it looks the same to me. So what do I know? I don't. And so it's one of these things that is so pivotal, whether or not she signed that. Now, he goes on to say, oh, it's against public policy, and it was buried, and one thing and another that makes it, unconscionable. I don't really know where it all ends up. But the other thing that bothers me about this case is this guy shafted lots of people out of at least $40 million.
Yes, sir.
Very notorious criminal here.
Correct.
This is a bad guy.
Right.
But how are we going to have all these variations in various districts about whether or not the affidavit, whether or not the signature is valid, and then whether or not the arbitration agreement is enforceable, and how we arbitrate? It seems that we're going to have a lot of spokes of the same wheel doing different things.
Well, Your Honor, I think the real fundamental question is, Doris Deputy has a Seventh Amendment constitutional right to trial by jury of her peers unless she has waived that right knowingly and signed these documents.
Well, see, that signature is just so important, whether or not she signed it, isn't it?
But Your Honor, let's weigh those two things for a moment. Here's a constitutional right that
you
every...
Know, look, arbitration is also public policy. Now, we can all say our opinions on arbitration, but it's not... If you sign the agreement and agree to it, that's favored.
I don't disagree with that. I may not agree with the policy, but I understand that that's the law. But I want to go back and say I think the court is thinking too much about the Malachinsky decision. I don't have any question that Judge Covert handled that correctly. But the real question was, that was one of a list of factors which he found made her opinion unreliable. If that were the sole one, maybe the court could say, I didn't like his terminology when he said rejected. But what he said was, she had her opinion, her report, has been rejected, and it was, based on the fact that she didn't give enough explanations. If you look at her report here, it's one sentence. One sentence. And it doesn't give the basis here either. She didn't outline in any detail which part of the signatures are favorably compared. How would the court, how would a fact finder have any idea what she really found?
Can you clear up one thing for me?
Sure,
before
Your Honor.
You sit down? As I understand, Lehman got into this near the end.
Yes, sir.
After he had built a lot of other people out of a lot of money, and apparently he had, the claim is that he signed her name on this.
Someone did.
Someone did, and your client says that's not my signature.
Correct.
I didn't sign it. Are the claims against the other brokerage houses in litigation?
Yes, sir.
So this is the only one that would be in arbitration?
Yes, sir. That's correct. And I
and
have
the
to
issues are the same in the other cases, essentially?
Essentially the scheme...
It's the liability, if any, that attaches
right
to the brokerage houses for not supervising.
That's right. And I have to turn, because Mr. Berberian said something, I almost jumped out of my chair. He said, There is absolutely no question that there was no misappropriation at Lehman Brothers. We haven't had a trial yet. There isn't an affidavit in this case. That's a preposterous, preposterous, out of the court, out of the record statement. It's simply not true. We know that that's not true, but that's not in front of you. But I don't want the court to be misled that Lehman Brothers now has established anywhere in this case or any other case that there wasn't misappropriation. That's nonsense. This was a breathtakingly long scheme to defraud people, and Lehman Brothers didn't do what it was supposed to do.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
What time you got? You have 2 minutes if you have anything else.
First of all, with respect to the misappropriations, it is a matter of record in this case. It is a letter that was sent to every client of Lehman Brothers that said if you had any funds misappropriated from you while your account was at Lehman Brothers will pay you 100 cents on the dollar, no strings attached, no release, no nothing. Here's the letter that went to Miss Deputy. There has never been any established misappropriations, nor are they out of her account.
Well, I assume that can happen, I mean, that whenever this all occurs. They agree to pay 100% if anything is proven.
No. If any client came up and said, here's the money that went out of my account that I didn't authorize going out of my account, Lehman Brothers wrote that client a check. On the spot, no release. Made the same letter, made the same offer, it's part of the record here, to Ms. Deputy. There are no funds misappropriated out of her account. The other thing, with result, repeatedly the claim has been made that what she's seeking is the phony value that was given to her. And Lehman Brothers did come in at the end. And the Supreme Court has made very clear in the Mitsubishi case that if there are some parties that should go into arbitration and other parties that don't, that's the result. That is the effect of arbitration. There is no question that it should be enforced. And the public policy strongly favors arbitration. The fact that there was a representation made that Judge Cleaver said you don't have to go forward today, that's nowhere there. What Judge Cleaver said is set forth at page 14 of our opening brief. He himself raised the Daubert issues on his own. There was not even an objection for our expert being qualified as an expert by opposing counsel when she testified. He raised all these concerns for the very first time while we were there, never gave us the option to come back another day. In fact, at the end of that day, I said, Judge, I have a meeting with the Securities and Exchange Commission the following morning in Washington. I cannot miss it. And he said, too bad, you got to keep going forward, have your local counsel take over. So this notion that we had the luxury of time to be able to work and go around this simply was not there, and that is all a matter of record. The other matter is that this is a case where, in Malinchinsky, her report was accepted. Her report was accepted. She wasn't allowed to testify beyond the scope of the report. And what I would say to you, with respect to the principles, page 26, she talks at length about, and this is in question to the judge's questioning about the principles that she applies. She talks about the closeness of the letters, the alignment, the heights, the strokes. She goes through all the things which handwriting experts go through. It's remarkably similar to what was done in the Third Circuit in the Valdez case. But the bottom line of all of this is, even if you reject her, the district court never, ever considered when we used an alternative route under 901 and the trial that's mandated under Section 4, we never got. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Case will be taken under advisement.